Hello, I am joining from Udugame. Tomorrow evening I'll come back. And we had the discussion in Singhala for 1 hour. Now we have about 1 hour for the English medium discussion. I will try to get down the Suttanipata Pali text. Otherwise, I don't have any book. So therefore, I am depending upon Venerable Buddharakkhita. Venerable, please continue with the... before going into that, if anyone is having any other interview reports or suggestions or any other comments to be given, we will give a few minutes and then we are going to invite Venerable Buddharakkhita to start the discussion, please.
Avasarai Ante, there is no reports from this end.
Good. Thank you, Kumar.
Sorry, can you hear me? Can you hear me now? No?
Better.
One should not be led into false speech. One should not engender affection for form. One should fully understand conceit. One should refrain from rashness. So again, the construction of this verse is a little, it forces you to think that this is like an order or telling you that this is what you should do. But in fact, these are natural qualities of the mind that arise in a diligent practitioner. So they're free of charge. They come with as a consequence of the practice. So you notice when meditators are diligently practicing, they become very cautious about their speech. They become very concerned that that they may have said something incorrect. So they become very sensitive to false speech. And they naturally are no longer so interested in form, in the beauty of something in particular, because they're enjoying the beauty of the whole process of mindfulness, mindful walking, mindful sitting. The breath becomes very beautiful, and the introspection, the looking inward becomes radiant and beautiful. So the outward form, the forms that we see in the world, are less impactful or less beautiful. Of course, they appreciate beauty. They appreciate nice music or nice anything, nice food, because they're highly sensitive to it. But in many ways, it becomes more the internal experience of that external thing that becomes important. So this is, it's not like we need to be miserable people and reject form, or that we need to be very miserable and, try to be truth seekers or activists in this kind of outward way that people get on about false speech. This is just a very natural consequence of diligent practice. It's quite an astonishing thing. One should fully understand conceit. So conceit is I am better than, I am the same as, or I am inferior to. So this is a judgment that naturally arises again in every moment, in every interaction that we have with any other human being. With every human being in every moment, even the same people day in, day out, we will have this constant judgment or a self, like an assessment of the world. I assess myself as superior, equal, or inferior to this other person that I'm interacting and engaging with. And this judgment is instantaneous, and it's associated with the emotion of shame. And so shame, you can say, is the feeling that arises when I assess myself relative to somebody else, that I am more beautiful, I am more ugly, I am more rich, I am more poor, I am more strong. And it gets quite gendered as well, where women are very sensitive to how they look. Are they attractive? Are they very beautiful? And men are like powerful. Am I powerful? Am I a man? Whereas, so this is like just a broad brushstroke of how shame is operating. And when we are mindful, when we have this very strong self-awareness that comes with meditation, we can see that inner conversation. And shame is a very interesting emotion. It's a kind of a constructed emotion. It develops between maybe 3 and 5. And it's not an emotion like a baby will have anger at 6 months, or if they don't like something, they have disgust. But this shame is a kind of a worldview. It's shaped by our society. It's shaped by our family. What exactly is shameful for me? You know, in some cultures, shame will be if you do this behavior, it's very shameful. If you in another culture, the same thing, it doesn't mean anything at all. So it can be very peculiar to the person, to their own personality, to their own. But it can also be general. It can be to their society, to their clan. So this assessment over conceit, to appreciate how conceitedness is operating, and to be intimate with conceit, to be alive to the moment-by-moment nature of that judgment, is to really put your finger on the pulse and to have a tremendous self-insight. And slowly, slowly, if you can have your finger on the pulse of conceitedness, then you see your own conceit, you see the conceit of others. And this is very close to this self, like I am, you know, I am. So before I am superior is I am. So if we go back to the, trace back to the causes, Yata Bhuta Dasana, the sort of smoldering heap that is this sense of ego, this sense of self, is I am. I am better, I am worse, I am the same. And the real breakthrough in the Dhamma arises when we really organically understand that this is different. So it's no longer I am. There is a process of body and mind. There is a process of nama rupa. And this is different. So it's not I am better than you. You and I are different. This is the only truth. So the arahants on becoming enlightened, when they would go to the Buddha, they wouldn't say things like, I have finished the path, or I am enlightened. They would say, this is different. This is different. So that was their declaration of enlightenment. So this is when one fully understands conceit. And this can only be realized through the Dhamma. This isn't like the Buddha telling the troops, you need to be careful of your conceitedness. You need to have no false speech, you lot. And you ignore all beautiful things. No, it's not like that. Like, so in that way, it's a little bit difficult how this is constructed, one should. Because in English, one should means it's like a command, or it can be conditional, you know. So really what he's saying is, look, that these are things that naturally arise, that if you're progressing along the path, these are the indications that you're moving along the path. You'll see the yogis having the sensitivity towards speech. You'll see that they're having a greater lack of interest. Like I personally, I find it really difficult to go on pilgrimage, you know, to go to these beautiful you know, places. I just have no interest. I'm like, this is boring. I'm not interested. I mean, of course, I mean, I like it. It's beautiful. It's nice. I recognize it. But it's boring at another level. Like, it's, you know what I mean? It can't sustain my interest. The same with music. I used to love music in the past. And now it's like, you know, I can't really sustain my interest on it. I'll hear it's synthetic. You know, they'll be trying to describe some emotion or love or whatever it is. And it's like, that's not exactly love. You know what I mean? Like the music is synthetic. It doesn't capture that emotion as it really is. So I prefer to experience that emotion in other people than have it interpreted or synthetically produced by a song because of the detailed mindfulness and attention. So one should not be attached to an attraction. So this again is just an object of fascination. So we should realize when we meet an object of attraction, an object of affection, an object of fascination, then we also realize that this is not substantial anymore. We see the fault in that object of affection, of attraction, of fascination. And it doesn't sustain our attention. Like I mentioned, as a practitioner, I find things that I really liked in the past, I'm not really super interested in anymore. They're no longer objects of attention or a fascination for me. And that's because, in a way, maybe I just see the anitta, the anatta, the dukkha in it, or there's something insubstantial in that object. It's not permanent anymore. It's not... it's lost its stickiness to my mind or to my attention. So just for Mahatero's help, since he's online and doesn't have the book, I'll read out the whole verse again. One should not be led into false speech. One should not engender affection for form. One should fully understand conceit. One should refrain from rashness. Maybe I would love to hear what Mahatero might have to say.
Sorry, I don't have the Sinhala book for the moment because I am speaking from a new place. Sometimes Venerable Dhammagupta may find the book, and if it is so, it will come soon. We have a rainy climate here and we have about 30 yogis. We just finished Sinhala medium translation, discussion, and same whole I am joining you all. As far as the verse and the Venerable Buddharakita's translation is concerned, he slightly touched it, of course. When we are born, our mind is fairly unconditioned. And once then, when we familiarize with the environment and the family and all the kind of things, slowly, slowly only, we start accumulating all the defilements. So in meditation, what we do is de-learning process, deconditioning process. So it is called coming back to the beginner's mind. And I think D.T. Suzuki, understanding the methodological, systematical way of the Theravada tradition, he put that into Mahayana Zen language and wrote the book, Beginner's Mind. Zen mind, beginner's mind. And I think many Westerners are reading it, and he tried to encapsulate the Theravada tradition, the gradual unconditioning or pratipada process, but it is the learning process. So we, when we are practicing, we can witness it. So at the beginning, we had the hard and fast, egotistic, black and white decisions. And we were very stereotyped. But as you keep on practicing in Vipassana specifically and lucid way of mindfulness, you try to accommodate the other's view and you just present your view and not rejecting others. That is called non-coercive method. In Venerable Jnanapanika's book, Art of Mindfulness, he explained that some aspects of mindfulness is non-coerciveness. It is not reacting with someone. And today you can see the political arena and you can see economical and social area. This is the truth. All the others are wrong. So much so, worse. More talking, more misunderstanding. But in mindfulness, we less and less talk. And before expressing ourselves, we take the responsibility, and therefore some may wrongly conclude the infant mind, the baby's mind is pure. But as verily Venerable mentioned, at six months' time, the baby himself try to express the anger, the happiness. That is how they are directed dispositions and the underlying currency, underlying tendencies are being expressed due to the impact of with the mother and the family members. So therefore, if you give mindful lesson, the training to the children at the age 5, some children used to say, mindfulness reduced my tension and frustration. Then the teacher is asking, Bhante, what kind of frustration having in the infant's mind? Tension. And we people, we think elderly people, we have tension, frustration, and mindfulness will erase it off, but they themselves, they have. And then we both explore into that, and then there were some articles at the age 3 of the child, if the mother going to give another parturate another baby, and sister, younger sister or younger brother, then these two, the elder one is start jealousy and kind of a this thing because he or she is losing the mother's attention, because mother's attention with the younger baby. So likewise, even that they have, the underlying tendencies are conditioned by the family, cultural, and all the kind of thing. So therefore, human elderly people can see, even the youngsters, they have tension frustration, it is less. Often they are blank. But the elderly people, often they are with tension and frustration. If your mindfulness is straightened, if your power line is straightened, then you can see the liberation, then you can see the contentment, then you can see the relaxation, then you can see no boundaries. So therefore, coming back word is called Yoniso Manasikara, radical reflection. About the beginning, more we become elder, more we assume things, mind become more conceited and corrupted. And therefore, even if you are becoming old, even if you are accumulating something, if you do it mindfully, not to take it as a burden, that is what exactly the monk's life. Monk, when he become elderly, he become more praiseworthy. But the other elderly people, due to their disorganized life, they are not happy. So therefore, mindfulness is the way back, together with the other noble eightfold path. This says, don't carry it away. Don't let your mind to carry away with the seeing and hearing. These are the main two things you will be carried away. Dasana Savan. That is why the audio visuals become the most powerful media. They are the advertisement they are using. And therefore, when you go to the forest, you are cut off from these manipulated sounds and manipulated views, but you have a very natural outlook here. And still the mind can entertain, but people, those who are appreciating the forestly atmosphere, may be different from the people appreciating the townships and the capital cities and the Times Square. So accordingly, you have to understand to whom you must associate. You must associate the deconditioning situation, because if you see the root cause of this Arthadanda Sutta, now they are about to fight each other, kill each other. Even the Buddha, he reflect himself rather than telling something to the others. How lucky I am not killing you. No one is about to kill me. That is because of my way of life. So therefore, you have to not only be mindful here, but you have to reflect it back and see how the anger is developing, how the hatred is developing, how the mindfulness is developing. That is because of the recurrent application. So therefore, learning from these suttas, we have to just get the cutoff, just get the split in the mindfulness, but that is just indicate your potential. Then onward, you have to adjust your way of life, not to leading to the more and more corruption, but to keep the mind in this no boundary situation, unexplainable situation and the freedom, and we are so lucky under the 100% setup of the world affairs, still we have this opportunity. Still we are progressing, and we can tell others, yes, world is in such a difficult situation, the tension, but it does not matter. We can practice. So that is what I would like to contribute. I would like to hear others' voices also.
I WhatsApped to you the a picture of the Pali and the Sinhalese. I don't know if somebody can bring it up for you. The verse.
I have the ebook. I will check it with Atta Anderson.
Should be on your phone.
You can continue.
Yeah,
please.
You know, while we're taking feedback from other yogis, you can have a look.
Thank you, Mahatero, and Sadhu, 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 and to Bhante for giving our teaching for today. I guess I'll just mention, I appreciate your interpretations and to help us understand how this verse pertains to our practice and the reconditioning process and the unconditioning of our conditioning from all the time we've spent in the world, conventional world, because there are so many things that block our understanding of experiencing things directly. And so meditation is very interesting for me, the way I've been considering it, how when we practice mindfulness, if we're walking meditation or sitting meditation, and in the Vipassana way, we're noting, or we're inclining the mind towards reality. So we're trying to see what's happening right now, and to experience this present moment through a direct knowing of through our senses. And so our mind gets engaged with the present moment and with present moment phenomenon. And so usually our mind is in the past or the future. So and it's involved with a self, an idea of self. But when we come back to the present moment and do meditation, we're actually coming into the present moment and experiencing things directly. And I just want to also say that the interview process is such a crucial part of this, because with a trained teacher and a great teacher like Mahatero, we can learn how to see where we're our self is coming up, and to bring us back to the present, inclining our mind towards what's actually happening with the meditation. So that's an amazing thing about this practice that I'm still just so thankful for it. This direct engaging with the present moment, and how that gradually helps us to see through the fabrications of our self that we construct, and our conceit and rash behavior. I wanted to say I looked up rashness, and because I wasn't really exactly sure what that was, but the verse says rash. Let's see, one should refrain from rashness. So rash is hastily or recklessly. And so I had to look up haste to be sure what this exactly is. So we can think, you know, recklessly, but also haste is quickness of motion and recklessness, hurrying. So I just wanted to bring those things up that, you know, and that, you know, we say do things mindfully, slowly, and silently. So that's exact opposite of rashness. So that's also, and I appreciate the way Bhante says we can, you know, this is put in the negative of should, but I appreciate a little bit of, you know, like, you know, the Buddha, you know, giving us a bit of a, you know, maybe encouragement would be better. You know, please, you know, try to incline towards, you know, truthful speech. Try to incline towards. So, I can see the should is off-putting for me as well. But, yeah. So, thank you, Bhante, and thank you, Mahatero.
Yeah, this translation of should is quite difficult for us in English. But a yogi should be developing these things naturally if they're practicing well. If they're not practicing these attributes of, then they're not really practicing well. So that's in that way they should. That's the course of the action. They should develop not lying, and they should develop a lack of affection for form. And if they're not developing that way, then there's something anomalous going on with their practice. So in that way, I take it as an indication of the course of the development of the yogi. So maybe we can ask if somebody else would like to participate.
If I am to add something, that normal practice also will not take up to that level. Once you develop normal mindfulness, you have to develop steadfast mindfulness. You have to develop the accelerated or reinforced or enhanced mindfulness. Then only you can go deep into your personality traits. Otherwise, you are just superficially organizing your moral restraint and concentration restraint. If you wish to go to the wisdom restraint, you must have steadfast mindfulness. That means very, very established. Satipatthana means that established mindfulness. Then only you can think about not to lie and not to have conceit, or otherwise whenever conceit arising, you are not going against, you can understand. Whenever conceit disappear, you can understand. And the sahasacharya, that means rushing and quickness, is some people doing self-mortification. That is also not done, because many monks and nuns are utterly in this extreme. They are self-hate kind of a character. Others are self-sensuous indulgence character. So what to understand, what your personality trait, and not to react, but to understand diagnostically, it must not be sahasa. Sahasa means not rushing, not recklessly. And we, by associating with our good friends, accepting others' criticism, only we can understand. Mindfulness must be internal and external. Internally, you must understand how quickly mind become unmindful. Mind become wandering, daydreaming, fantasizing. And other way, you can understand by associating true people and good, noble people, your mind is often come back to the mindfulness. But if you have wrong people, and instead, if you have a reflector, if you have good friends, those who can give you remarks about your behavior, that's the best. But the thing is, it is sometimes it is irritating. So therefore, it is not normal mindfulness. This must be steadfast mindfulness. Then only you can think about how much you are rushing to something and how much you are lethargic, just like we discussed in the last week, to something. And that is a thing you can see in group actions. By dialogue, you can understand. And to get rid of that quickness and rushness and kind of thing, you must not rush. You have to understand something. For some things, we are very hidden. We are very rushing. We are not heeding. We are arrogant. So just seeing itself is enough. But when you are arrogant, you can't start mindfulness. You must have already developed well-established mindfulness. Then only you can see your arrogance with or without the help of the others. And still, you may not be ready to accept it. So that means you have prepared the medicine, you have not taken the medicine. So when we are living in the monastic life, we have a lot of such encounters, but each time we are not using efficiently. But I think day by day, we are becoming efficient. That is my contribution, my opinion. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Mahathero. Good morning, Mahathero. I gave this should not and should a kind of a little thought about it. And I feel that what is written here is that what the Buddha is saying is that we should, the should and should not is the natural consequence of doing things. For example, when he says one should fully understand conceit, the other side of saying it is one should not be given to being conceited, but actually the natural side of things is we are usually conceit. We usually don't know what is conceit, so we should fully understand conceit. And when we tend our mind towards mindfulness, we understand that we have this conceit in us. So should is kind of like a, when you do something, you should see this. So when you should not, when should not is happening in the writing, it feels that when you are mindful, you should not be led into false speech. So you naturally tend not to go into false speech, because the other way of saying it is one should be giving correct speech, but one is usually not giving correct speech, only with mindfulness, and then one would not be led into false speech or should not be led into false speech. So it feels like the should and should not feels like a natural progression of mindfulness, progression practice of mindfulness, and it feels smooth. No, instead of saying the other way, when the Buddha said it this way, it feels smooth. It feels like you're going with the flow of the practice.
Mahathera, I wanted to add one thing. Was it's the importance of sila and sila is where we shouldn't do things. So we remember the rules and we remember the practices and the traditions. But then naturally you get this adi sila, you get this higher sila that comes with panya. And so we just don't do those things anyway. They naturally fall away. So it doesn't become an imposition anymore. The rule becomes natural. I remember one verse saying that that one of the arahants, he made the vinaya his home. So these restrictions, initially when we have to tell the yogis to not talk too much, practice noble silence on the retreats, or not to be too distracted, giving attention to the beautiful rupa or the objects around the hall, and not to be conceited, when we have to give that imposition. But over time, it just becomes very natural, where it becomes cumbersome or laborsome, because panya is already seeing through the impurities or the defects of that kind of silly action, and it just naturally drops away, and we achieve what they call adi sila, a higher sila, a natural sila that is imbued with wisdom and insight, and therefore the foolishness drops away, and we don't need the external imposition of rules or enforcement or law, or the discipline becomes the path itself.
So the understanding of the sila and adi sila is one has to understand within. For example, noting in the meditation, at the beginning you have to keep on noting in breath, out breath, left, right. But when it is become mastered, when become autopiloting, you can do away with noting, but still you can see the natural characteristics. You can see intrinsic characteristics. So there you must be smart enough to get the benefit of noting, but without noting. That is called power of thinking without thinking. So that is the point where the inferential knowledge come into being. Otherwise, if you keep on noting, no chances for the inferential knowledge or deductive knowledge to come. So that part, yogi can't take the responsibility. They think the master must do it, or the nature must do it, or it must be happening naturally. No, you have to. You have to change the gear from the gear number one to second as the engine is, as the car is moving, and then second to the third to the fourth, like, of course, with the automatic gear, it is immaterial, but all cars, they have the gear. It depends on the momentum. You go to the top with the risk. So changing from the first gear to the second gear, third gear, is something like the mindfulness is changing into the mindfulness as a faculty, and mindfulness as a power, and mindfulness as a factor of enlightenment. So these things very quickly goes up and down, like downward hill, upward hill like. So it doesn't matter, third gear is better than the second gear. You have to use it accordingly. But by reading interview reports, they don't like it. They wanted to have a chauffeur-driven car. Without handling the gears, he must have a smooth run. But driving is a enjoyable job. So likewise, mindfulness itself is evolving 8 times as you keep on practicing. So therefore, daily you must start like a beginner. Whenever the mind becomes seasoned, whenever the mind becomes with a good constellation, you must let loose. The last time when Buddha Rakhita really introduced that when the cows are released to the forest, you must not worry. You can just be in the shed and play music. But if someone come and ask where are the cows, then you get agitated and then you have to run. But otherwise, or just like try climb into a top of a tower, that little losing is not sahasa. It is kind of an invitation from the nature that your mindfulness is fair enough. Let loose the boundaries. Let loose the restraint. Let loose all the other interpretations. So mind will go into the flow, as in Singaporean try to mention. That you can't go with the flow as far as you are too much restrained. So present day forest monks are too much with restraint. And I can't see a difference from the foreign monks and the local monks, but that is the part. So whenever I became monk after practicing, so my teachers found that I am kind of a not well restrained person, not unruly like, but I keep that bumpkin nature, the village nature, because that's the way I entertain my monk's life. Not according to the others' reflections, not according to the others' images, but I like to share with them. I like to accept and accommodate them, but how, when to put the first gear to the second gear, no one can do it for me. I have to do. And again, from the second to the one, without hesitation, I must come back. So that is very well reflected in interview reports. So daily I am listening so much of interview reports, and there I try my best. Have restraint, but whenever it is ready to let loose, you must let loose. does not indicate it's the forever. You must again come back to the restraint. So when to apply it to the which gear, it depending on the weight, depending on the ramp, depending on the engine power, a lot of things. So you are learning them as you continue. That is my opinion.
Yeah, they're all quiet here, Bhante. It's been very nice listening to the feedback this morning. It's a real achievement of technology that you can be in a rainy forest somewhere, and we're in a rainy forest here, and we can have this, we can continue this dialogue. It's quite remarkable. We're using technology for good. So we're mastering
Yesterday we tried but failed because of the failure of the technology. So we gave it up. But today we are 100% successful because of the distance and a lot of people from this side also. And they were heavily, effectively participated in the single medium. And that was an opening for them to understand these things are happening, how to get connected with the Zoom. And that is how we will be going to a live radio instead of Zoom. Maybe in 2 months' time, we will be going for a radio. And this is a kind of a rehearsal for technological advancement. Well, this is information for all the English medium yogis.
Yes, so it's quite remarkable how the nature of the mind is that it isn't necessarily fixed in one place. And if we have skill, we can skillfully move our mind to different places. Just like now, your mind is with us here in the Dhamma hall, and we can engage in a communication, in a conversation, in a dialogue back and forth. So this is us using technology for its purpose as a useful way and a means. And so again, this is a note to people who use technology, learn how to use it to your benefit so that you're a master of the technology and that the technology is not mastering you, and that you have skillful attention and it's of benefit to you, not just now, but in the future as well.
Okay, I thank Venerable Dhammagutta. He connected us as well as give the soft copy of the Artha Danda Sutta. I would like to take a few minutes so that Dhammagutta can show this monastery. He can show you the Udugama Nikrodhalena monastery, and after that it will be the end of the discussion. If someone is having, I can still take a few minutes. If there are no other opinion, no other questions, remarks, we are going to use the technology a little further.
Yeah, there's nothing from this side. Maybe we can, if you don't mind, Bhante, we will take our leave, and because we don't have any viewing stuff here. So maybe we'll
You don't have it, or then no use.
No. Understand. I thought you were going to share it with the worldwide Dhamma audience, but not here in Nisaranamana. So maybe we'll
okay,
just...
Okay, still then I will ask Venerable Dhammagutta to show the Nikrodhalena Aranya. Thank you very much for the participation.
We'll sign out. Yes, thank you, Sukihoto. Okay. Okasa Wandami Bhante. Okasa Dwara Diena Katang Sabang Lachiang Kamatame Bhante. Sadhu Okasa Kamatame Bhante. Duty Ambiti.